So here we are. We're looking at what is a Dharmachari, what is a member of the Triratna Buddhist order. What does ordination mean? We've been exploring that. What does it mean to live the Dharma life, to fare in the Dharma life, to go along practicing in the Dharma life? We've been trying to really understand and get a feeling for Sangharakshita's vision of the Dharma life, the Buddhist life. And so far it looked quite a bit at the ordination ceremony, picking up particularly on, in the first talk, on the preceptor and looking at that whole acceptance verse of, with loyalty to my teachers I accept this ordination. And we carried on yesterday talking particularly about harmony and concord and unity, picking up on the second of the acceptance verses, in harmony with friends and brethren I accept this ordination. And today I want to concentrate on the third of the acceptance verses, which is for the attainment of enlightenment I accept this ordination. For the attainment of enlightenment I accept this ordination. I mean, first of all, it's worth, some people might think, well, that ought to come first in the acceptance verses. But it's perhaps significant that it comes third, because it's making it clear that you accept your ordination within the context of a community of teachers and friends, Kalyana Mitras and so on, yes, that are indeed aspiring to attain enlightenment, but you're practicing it within that context. And of course, this is what the tradition has always been very, very clear about, that you practice within a context, an environment. I think I mentioned in one of the talks that experience of the Buddha after his enlightenment, that extraordinary event where he reflects on how painful it is for a man not to revere another. And the words that he uses for revering and relying upon are really the words of someone wanting a teacher, wanting a community. And of course, he realizes that's not available. So he has to revere the Dharma. And as I said yesterday, he creates really a community of teachers and friends and disciples in order that people can attain liberation, attain enlightenment. The Buddha himself on one occasion said that he is the Kalyana Mitra, the Kalyana Mitra to the world. He is the spiritual friend to the world. If he was not the spiritual friend to the world, there would be no means to liberation. So that's a really important, you know, text for us. But here we are, for the attainment of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. We get ordained in order to attain enlightenment. This is so important, so crucial. And reflecting this morning on this particular theme, I have to admit I got into a rather funny mood, and I'm still in that mood. I'm finding it rather hard to speak, which some of my friends will find deeply shocking. And perhaps it's the subject, enlightenment, Bodhi, Nirvana, whatever you want to call it. I mean, first off, it's made very, very clear in the tradition that enlightenment, Nirvana, is a takavacharo. It's beyond the reach of reasoning. It's beyond thought. It's beyond speech. It's beyond anything constructed and conditioned. It's beyond all our constructed experience. You know, and I'm just very mindful of that. I could, of course, you know, be cheap and just sit in silence or hold up a golden flower and hope that you get it. But that really would be cheap, or do some sort of fancy footwork, you know, do a direct pointing to you at the nature of mind or something. But that's not going to happen, you'll be pleased to know. But I think perhaps that's the first thing we need to reflect upon, that we use words like enlightenment, awakening, wisdom and compassion, the Buddha, Bodhi, Nirvana. You know, because all of us have got, you know, some degree of education. We can all read books or listen to talks. And, you know, we hear all these words. And it's very, very easy to think that we know what it means. You know, it trips off the tongue. It trips off my tongue. I mean, I can sort of talk about anything with great conviction and authority. And actually, I don't really know what I'm talking about. You know, when I was at school, my parents went to a parent-teacher's evening. They were told that, you know, how persuasive I could be. I could carry people with me for good or ill. That's what was said, which is, you know, it's always sort of been there. So, you know, I'm very, very conscious of that, of how easy it is to speak. But then the tradition is very, very clear. And I think we need to really meditate on that. Really meditate on that that time after the Enlightenment, after the Buddha had seen, where he's spending a lot of time meditating underneath various trees around Aruvala. And there's that meditation that he undergoes, where he really meditates on the profound mystery of the Dharma, reality, the truth, the ultimate truth in this case. He reflects something along the lines of, this Dharma that I have attained, he does use that word attained, is extremely peaceful, deeply peaceful. And peace here means it's beyond all the agitation of greed, hatred and delusion. It's Shanta, the three Shantis that we intone at the end of the puja, is actually intoning Nirvana. It's intoning enlightenment. It's the pacification of greed, hatred and delusion. And that's why after those three Shantis there should be absolute silence for as long as possible. Nobody moves, nobody thinks at that point. There should be no agitation. That's where the puja, as it ends in that deep silence. So this Dharma that I have found, that's been revealed, is deeply peaceful, extremely peaceful. It is calm, peaceful, calm. And it's the complete cessation of all constructions, all conditions. And it is atakavachara, beyond all reasoning, all conceptualization, beyond all logic, beyond all thought. It's beyond words. It's achintya. It's inconceivable. It's nisprapancha. It's beyond any mental proliferation. And, you know, he reflects like this on the Dharma. Deep, you know, it's more than a reflection. It's a deep realization. And then he kind of considers the world. He considers people. He considers this world. And he realizes that actually this is so transcendent. It's so lukutra. It's so beyond the ways of the world, the way we are, that people won't see it. They're so tied up with their craving, their hatred, their delusion. They're so tied up with their stuff, with their own ideas and all the rest of it. They can't see it. They won't see it. And it would be vexing. It would be troublesome to attempt to communicate it and people not seeing it. So he's inclined not to teach. He's inclined not to communicate. And, you know, we do know what happens next. He looks again out of compassion and so on. But I think it's very important to stay with that particular experience of the Buddhas. Stay with the transcendence of Buddhahood. Sometimes people get very afraid of this language of transcendence. They sort of start feeling bad about themselves and, you know, well, I can't get there and I can't do it. They turn it into a sort of Christian God and all that sort of thing and a weird ideal. It's not that. That's not the point of this particular story. You know, presumably it's true. There is this part of the Buddha that's just so other that you know, we can't reach him you know, in the particular state in which we're in at the moment. But it's also communicating something to us practically. You know, presumably the Buddha told this story about this for a particular reason. He's trying to indicate something. He's trying to communicate the beyondness of the Dhamma in its fullest sense, the beyondness of him, of the Buddha, and really opening up this whole area of reverence and mystery for us. And I think that's so important. It's so important that we preserve that, that there is a sense of, yes, holiness, sanctity, if you like, around the Buddha's attainment. I think us moderns, you know, it's a great thing that we've been freed up from, you know, restricting and oppressive traditions and so on and so forth. But we've also lost something. We've lost the capacity to revere. That's actually been taken away from us, that revering, that sense of the weight of the mystery of the way things are. This Gaurava quality, the word for reverence in Pali is Gaurava, and it literally means weighty or heavy. It's the sort of the sublime, you could say. It's the sublime, you know, the deeper, you know, sense of things. And, you know, yes, we have this very kind of casual sort of culture, in a way, throwaway culture. And it's reverence is not valued. This idea of really looking up to somebody or something, you know, genuinely, because we really feel its weight, is not seen as something important. In a way, you'd be regarded as a bit of a fool if you did that. You know, what we have instead is the cult of celebrity and notoriety. You know, it's what seems to be the, which has got nothing to do with revering. It's to do with something else. I don't really know what it's to do with psychologically. But this revering of the mystery of the Dharma is extremely important. If we're going to start thinking in terms or feeling in terms of attaining enlightenment, it's really important to have that sense of that enlightenment is really beyond us. Sangharakshita, you know, said recently in a discussion with Subhuti that feeling that you are really far from enlightenment, that you are really completely alienated from it, that it's really absent, is a path. You know, he really picks up on some of the mystics in, you know, Christianity, where, you know, God's absence is a sort of path. But he's saying that that's true with Buddhahood, to really sort of feel that it's far away and you are not near it. He gave a sort of paradoxical statement that those who feel that they're close to enlightenment are probably a very long way from it. And yet, paradoxically, those who feel it's far away are probably nearer to it. So, of course, we're all saying we're far away now as a sort of tactic. But you can see what he means. You can see what he's getting at. I think I mentioned yesterday when that discussion about Buddha nature and the way he was talking, you got the sense that the Buddha, therefore enlightenment, was something vast, immense, and not something that you could, you know, you could just, you know, pull and incorporate into yourself. I think that's why we need to be really, really not entertain these things to do with, you know, that we are the Buddha already. You know, I think we should really reject that way of talking. We have the potential, sure, but we are not enlightened. We're very far from it. Also, this the Zen story, if you see the Buddha on the road, you should kill him. I heard this on Radio 4 last week. Melvin Bragg's In Our Time was on Zen, and that was the first thing that he quoted. If you see the Buddha on the road, you should kill him. We shouldn't have anything to do with that language. That might be appropriate within a context of, and one of the speakers on this program was very good articulating the whole context of monastic training, that these are guys who are seriously absorbed in an entire Buddhist life. Maybe that has some relevance there, but for us, not. We've got to really learn to revere and worship enlightenment in the form of the Buddha if we're going to get anywhere near moving towards the attainment of enlightenment. So yes, there's the Buddha, thinking in terms of not communicating, really getting a sense of the sort of transcendence of things. And he needs to be entreated. I think I'm going to talk a bit about compassion tomorrow. But one thing that compassion isn't, it's not a free gift. I think I might have said the other day that we shouldn't think that the Buddha's compassion is like, you know, mum's love or something like that, or grandmother's love. You know, that, you know, whatever you do, however you are, Buddha's going to come along and love you and hold you and take you to Buddhahood. No chance. No way. Absolutely not. The Buddha needs to know that we are serious and we are interested. He needs to be entreated. There needs to be something that will, as it were, keep him in relationship, because his being is floating off. It's floating off. I remember Aloka saying that when he first got involved in the movement, he said it was really interesting because he had the sense that Sangharakshita was like this, you know, great big helium balloon that was just sort of, you know, really kind of taking off, and the people around, the older members, were trying to sort of pull him back and pull him down. It's a very interesting image, isn't it? There is this sense of this otherness of enlightenment. One of the things that the Buddha sees. Let's just wind back a bit. Let's just stay with the Buddha absorbing enlightenment beneath the Bodhi tree. There's a wonderful collection of suttas called the Udana, the verses of uplift. And the first first collection of suttas is called the Bodhi suttas, or the Bodhi tree suttas, because they're all about the Buddha's enlightenment or the Buddha's awakening, whichever language you prefer. They're very short suttas. And in the 1970s, Sangharakshita did two seminars on this collection called the Udana. The first of them under canvas, down in Cornwall, where he was on retreat. You know, the original Buddha field, if you like. And some of my order member friends were on that seminar. Bhante would come out every day from his the chalet in which he was staying. He'd go into this tent where they were all gathered. I've seen photographs of him in this time. He's wearing his tweedy jacket and jeans and a pair of those. Do you remember those bumpers, those black and white sort of basketball boots, we used to call them? He was wearing those, amazing. Get up, long hair, really long hair, looking a bit like a gypsy, really. He does have a Hungarian background, doesn't he? He's sitting, you know, great photographs of him. And when you read the seminar, it's very interesting what he does in with these suttas. The suttas are very short, so they're, thus have I heard, the Bhagwan, the Lord, was staying at Aruvala, having just won, beneath the Bodhi tree, having just won, attained the highest enlightenment, and he stayed for 7 days and seven nights in one posture, without moving, enjoying the bliss of liberation, the Sukha Vimoksha, the Sukha Vimoksha. And then after that time, he turned his mind to looking into the nature of things. And he saw this being that becomes, on the arising of this, that arises. Then it describes the Nidana chain. And it goes through the different suttas, the formula of Pratichasamutpada. And it's very, very interesting the way Sangharakshita meditates on this particular, these particular stories, these particular incidents. And I should just add that after the Buddha describes his vision of Pratichasamutpada, he gives an udana, an inspired utterance. I think the third one goes something like, when things, when dhammas grow clear to the fiery, deeply absorbed in meditation Brahmin, he, like the sun lighting up the sky, disperses Mara and his army. Something like that. It's a free translation. So let me give you a little bit of an insight into Sangharakshita's meditation on the Buddha's enlightenment or post-enlightenment experience. First of all, there's this business of the Buddha enjoying the... Now let's start with this word Brahmin in the Udana. Let's go there. Sangharakshita feels that the way the Buddha is using the word Brahmin is definitely not in the caste sense, the later very rigid caste sense. He thinks that what the Buddha might have in mind is the way the Brahmin was term Brahmin was originally used. The Brahmin was the sort of shaman of the tribe. He would be the one that kind of goes off and gains privileged knowledge to guide the tribe. So he wonders if actually the Buddha is using the term in that sense, so that the Buddha himself, of course, is somebody who's gone alone, completely alone, off into the forest. He's wearing his rag robes, sitting there in meditation. And this is an inspiration for this Buddha Rupa. When I talked to Arloka about the painting, the original painting that we had in the other shrine room, I said that we really want to have a Buddha like the way Bhante evokes him in the Udana. And Arloka knew what I was talking about because he was on one of these Udana seminars. And you can see the patched robes. So there's this sense of going out alone. And he is, of course, discovering privileged knowledge, special knowledge, vidya, knowledge which isn't of this world. And it's not to guide the tribe, but it's to show the way of liberation for all men, the path to enlightenment. So Sangharakshita meditates on this particular instance. That's the first thing he said. So the Buddha, you've got to understand that the Buddha's like that. And of course, he's in this state of the bliss, the sukha, the ecstasy of liberation. It's very, very important. If we're talking about enlightenment, we need to understand that it is bliss. It's ecstatic, overwhelming bliss, the bliss that floods over all boundaries. If somebody tells you they're enlightened or they have insight and they're miserable, persistently miserable, don't believe them. And if they come up with some sort of fancy, oh yeah, but you know, I've got insight and that's sort of making me go through my dark night of the soul, and that goes on week after week, year after year, don't believe them. If it's really got insight, if it's really got the quality of realization, sooner or later there's going to be bliss, there's going to be happiness. Because you're melting your self, your rigid sense of self, with all your hang-ups and weirdness and neuroses and all the rest of it, that's going to be blown out of the water. So there's going to be bliss and liberation, expansion, openness. And it's that, by the way, that quality of the bliss that becomes love and compassion. That's, because you want to share that happiness and liberation with others, that joy. So there's the Buddha experiencing the bliss of liberation for 7 days, multiples of 7 days. And immediately Sangharakshita picks up on the word seven, magic number in Indian tradition, magic number, out of time. This isn't to do with linear time at all. I mean, you could sit for 7 days and 7 nights without moving. It's been done, apparently, in deep meditation. But that's not really what we're talking about here. We're talking about eternity. We're talking about the timeless. And Sangharakshita sort of feels that what's really going on here, he said, what would have happened after the Buddha has seen into the nature of things is a very, very deep absorption. A very, very deep absorption. He said you have to sort of, really try and reflect on the Buddha's life beforehand. He's made all this effort. His whole being, his whole focus has been in this search for liberation, this search for the end of dukkha. And he said it's as if what happens with, it's as if the Buddha's life becomes this tremendous body of water, this great torrent that's flowing along, and then at a certain point it goes over the edge. It goes right over the edge. And that going over the edge is vimoksha, it's liberation, it's enlightenment, it's bodhi, it's the bliss of liberation. So there is going to be absorption, deep, deep absorption. And then Sangharakshita feels what starts to happen there, then, when the Buddha starts to look into Pratityasamutpada. When you read the text, it's terribly clunky and analytical. Sangharakshita doesn't believe it's like that. But what is really going on is, if you like, the Buddha's different levels of the Buddha's mind starts to work again, if you like. He starts to see the principle that is best expressing what he's seen, that which is beyond word, that which comes in just one flash, as it were. One flash. You know, which is, you know, not a moment, it's out of time. He starts to see, well, how can, you know, what is he seeing? And what he sees is becoming. You know, becoming. The best way to articulate what is seen, which is beyond words, but not, you know, it doesn't mean that when the Buddha starts to articulate this even to himself, though the words he uses for that are unimportant, you know, or accidental or irrelevant. And some people, you know, you talk like that. They talk about, well, the ultimate truth is beyond words, so it doesn't matter what you say. Well, that's absolutely ridiculous. You know, the Buddha's, you know, articulation of the Dharma into concepts and words means something. It's the best kind of mirror and reflection for us, practically, that expresses what he's seen. And what he sees is becoming. He sees that nowhere is there anything fixed and unchanging. There's no permanent soul or self. There's no creator. There's no cause. There's just this vast becoming. These, if you like, it's a sort of vision, if you like, of almost energies, you know, becoming, moving into different states, different crystallizations, if you like, and moving in and out of those crystallizations. This becoming and re-becoming according to people's deeds, their actions, their behavior, karma, in other words, what they do, what mental states they indulge, the way they will, just bringing them round and round and round. So he sees this process of Pratityasamutpada, conditioned co-production. Do you remember the first chapter of the survey? The essence of enlightenment? It's Pratityasamutpada. That's what we really start to need to get a real feeling for if we're serious about attaining enlightenment. So, you know, really read up that first chapter of the survey of Buddhism. And the way, you know, Sangharakshita, you know, something that Sangharakshita himself has deeply pondered, Pratityasamutpada, deeply pondered. And when he, in that book, The Thousand Petal Lotus, the Rainbow Road, he talks about his journey into the Dharma. He said when he started, he said it was a sort of quasi-spiritual love affair. You know, he read the Diamond Sutra, he read the Sutra of Huineng when he was 16 and had that flash of insight into the nature of it all, realised that he was a Buddhist and always had been a Buddhist. And that started his journey. And you can read in his, particularly the poems he writes when he's a young man in India, the intense devotion to the Buddha, particularly. Intense devotion. You know, very inspired by, you know, Indian poets like Rabindranath Tagore. There's one, you know, particular poem which ends with the phrase, "When will he come? When will he come? When will he come?" And he's really writing about the Buddha. He's really writing about the Buddha to come to him. So a lot of faith, a lot of devotion. But then he talked about a particular period where he felt that he needed to go much deeper. I mean, he did obviously have a very good grasp of the Dharma. So he spends his time in retreat. This is before he's ordained, when he's in South India, you know, with his friend Satchapriya, when they're living as these real wanderers who've really gone forth, and they kind of holed up in this haunted ashram. And he describes this period where he just concentrates on really getting to grips with Pratitya Samuppada, the Lakshanas, the Four Noble Truths, reading and rereading, you know, these particular texts, the middle 50 discourses of the Middle Length Sayings, Mrs. Rhys David's book on the Home University Library book on Buddhism. And he said, he describes how he'd read this in the day. He'd walk up and down on the veranda of the ashram, reflecting on this material. And at night, when he's meditating, you know, and he'd been doing the mindfulness of breathing regularly, but when he's meditating, he said he'd have flashes of insights into the truth which these words were the expression of, into their sort of, as it were, transcendental counterparts. You just see, you know, directly. It's a model, you know, description of the practice of listening, reflecting, and meditating. You know, the three kinds of wisdom. You know that. You know, first of all, you need to really understand what the teaching is. Then you reflect upon it, and then you see it in the depths of meditation. So, Pratitya Samuppada, if we're going to be serious about attaining enlightenment, we really need to start seeing into Pratitya Samuppada, conditioned co-production, this being that becomes, on the arising of this that arises, this not being that does not become, on the ceasing of this that ceases. It's really, really important to meditate on this, reflect on this. And one of the things that Sangharakshita has done with his own meditations on this, he's brought out that teaching of the Buddha, which is rather neglected in the Pali sources, but which is there, but rather neglected, and it was, you know, particularly Mrs. Rhys Davids who drew attention to it. This teaching that there isn't just the Pratitya Samuppada that describes the wheel, you know, in dependence upon ignorance arises the volitional activities, dependence upon the volitional activities arises consciousness, and so on. There is the teaching of the spiral path, as he later called it, the teaching of the transcendental condition co-production, the condition co-production, the conditions that you build up that lead to the attainment of enlightenment. So an incredibly important teaching and principle, and one I think which can be very, very easily neglected. I think sometimes people are so almost obsessed with attaining enlightenment or insight, they end up trying to grab it and grasp it as something that you add on to yourself. This is something that Sangharakshita has gone into in this. There's a lecture in here called Enlightenment as Experience and as non-experience. Extremely important lecture. I had the good fortune to be there, given in about 1975 in London. It was the first time I saw Sangharakshita lecture, and he was majestic, absolutely amazing there, standing in his purple suit and with a high-collar Tibetan shirt on and his long hair. And you know, it was like going to a lecture by Coleridge or something, the great romantic poet and philosopher. This magnificent, you know, speech, you know, summoning, you know, really talk, well, not just talking about the Dharma, but the whole crisis, if you like, of modern man. Enlightenment is experience and non-experience. And one of the things that he really critiques is the whole language of experience, which is used still so much. He says it's not there in the tradition. There isn't really a Pali or Sanskrit word for experience. And yet people go on about the experience of enlightenment, or the experience of nirvana, or the experience of insight, or meditative experience. He says it's not there. And he thought that the overemphasis on experience was to do with people feeling a tremendous inner impoverishment and emptiness. And they bring that, you know, that craving to fill that yawning pit of inner emptiness even to the spiritual life. And they try to grab an experience. They try to grab it from, you know, some guru or other. They try to grab it through emphasizing a particular technique. Only this technique will yield the experience of enlightenment. You know, and they try to grab it, you know, through being involved with something exotic. So he really critiques this language of experience. And he critiques it from the point of view of looking at things, from the point of view, really, of conditioned co-production. It's not about getting something. Even the language of attainment can have the sense of getting something. We, as we are now, getting something, drawing it to us, you know, to make us feel better, to make us feel safe and all right. That's not the way this works. We need to think much more in terms of developing a deep feeling for Pratitya Samuppada in this progressive spiral form. You need to develop a real feeling for the conditions, the flow of the conditions which bring about our transformation, our change, our spiritual death and spiritual rebirth, so that enlightenment, as it were, emerges. It's not something that we have, it's something, you know, much more likely that we enter into or we live. So let's let's just dwell on that for a bit. Really getting a feeling for you know, enlightenment as, you know, the attainment of enlightenment or the journey to enlightenment as this engagement or this setting up of the conditions that lead to liberation, that lead to enlightenment. Just dwell on that for a bit. I need to just gather my thoughts. There's a number of directions I could go in at this point. First of all, I want to mention something. I had a conversation with a young man a few months ago, and he asked me a very good question. He said, do you believe that you can attain enlightenment in this life? Are you doing that? And, you know, it's a very, very good question. And I found myself sort of chuckling a bit. And the first thing I said, well, I don't believe that I can attain enlightenment, in the sense that me, as I am now, can get enlightenment. For enlightenment to happen, there's going to have to be a profound transformation. I believe that transformation is possible. I believe that transformation, if you like, in the enlightenment, in the light of enlightenment, is possible, and to some extent is beginning to happen. But the idea that me now can get enlightenment, I just don't believe that. And I found it very interesting articulating that, because I contrasted that with how I was when I was younger. When I was younger, I thought, I'm going to gain enlightenment. I'm going to gain this thing. You know, I'd throw myself into meditations, on meditation retreats, really going for it, you know, really cracking my knees and hips and all the rest of it to break through. You know, and sometimes I'd be on retreats with, you know, meditation teachers, and there'd be that kind of vibe. You know, we'd read the stories of the Zen masters, Dogen and so on, and sit and do fantastic pujas, and that was good. I don't think that was a bad thing at all. I think it's what a young man, in a sense, should be doing, but I think there was a delusion in that, and various experiences, particularly of humiliation about my ethics, the state of my ethics, revealed to me over the years that no, actually, if enlightenment is to really shine, then there's got to be a transformation. You've got to do a lot more work, a lot more basic work, you know, on yourself. At the same time, in this conversation, I realised with this person that I was talking to, that I felt that in some way, and I know this could sound like a bit of a claim, that enlightenment, Bodhi, the Buddha, whatever you want to call it, is a sort of presence in my life. very distant, very far away, very muffled, and no doubt distorted through the sort of prism of my own cleshas and defilements and so on and so forth. But every day I do everything I can to recollect enlightenment. Every day I do everything I can to recollect the Buddha, to have that as a reference point in my life. I don't do it nearly enough as I should. But I hope to some extent informing or perfuming, my life. And I relate this to Praticca Samuppada in the sort of spiral form. The beginning of that path, in the one that we're most familiar with, is independence upon dukkha arises shraddha. Independence upon dukkha arises shraddha. Independence upon suffering arises faith. Independence upon unsatisfactoriness arises faith. Just that very, very simple phrase. Independence upon suffering arises faith. And it's one of those things, you've read it many times, you've probably gone through the spiral path in your mitra study regularly, and so on and so forth. But that nidana, that link, that movement, it sums up, describes so much. I would say it describes, really, a Dharmachari's life. A Dharmachari should really be one who's constantly in that space of dependence upon dukkha arises shraddha. We come to the Dharma because of dukkha, don't we? That's what gets us thinking. Do you remember that wonderful essay of Bhante, where Buddhism begins and why it begins there, and why he goes into the question, why does the Buddha place dukkha as the first noble truth? And he's making the point because it's an emotion, because it's a feeling. Pain is a feeling. The Buddha's not interested in kind of presenting a philosophy. He's saying we start to wake up when we recognize that life is painful and unsatisfactory. And I know some of us have had very, very difficult and painful lives. And that gets us searching, really searching, for some sort of answer. Now that dukkha, that sense of suffering, needs to be refined. It needs to be developed and cultivated. At first, inevitably, it's very personal. Our sense of dukkha. It's very personal. We're in a psychological mess. Maybe we're in a physical mess. And that gets us searching for the Dharma. And we find the Sangha and we take up meditation and we start to feel an alleviation of that. Maybe it's we assuage our loneliness. Good thing too. We discover friendship. We discover a path of ethics that can help us. But we've got to go deeper than that. We've got to realise this dukkha is not personal. Because I've seen people even within the order, there's this, they do have a sense when they come along and in their ordination training and maybe just after ordained that their turban is on fire. The analogy that the Buddha uses for dukkha. There you go. Your turban's on fire, matey. Get it off. And get onto the path. But what happens is, what can easily happen to us, is that we sort out the sort of gross dukkha. We kind of sort that. We kind of become a more adjusted, human being, a bit more positive, a bit more together. And basically we use that to kind of make it in the world. Just to have a kind of comfortable Buddhist life. A kind of Buddhist rut, if you like. A Buddhist rut. It's reasonably positive. I mean, it's not as harmful as the life beforehand, fair enough. But it's not really going anywhere. We're just nice Buddhists who do good things together. Use Buddhist language and, all the rest of it. But we're sort of stuck. It's especially dangerous, if you give talks a lot on the Dharma. And, people think you're really wonderful and all the rest of it. And you've been ordained a long time. It's especially dangerous, when you're in that position. I'm speaking personally. You know, that you've got to sort of push on. You've got to sort of realise, no, we haven't just sorted this out. It's not just about rearranging samsara. This dukkha is much deeper than just physical pain and psychological pain. It is existential. It's this skanda dukkha, this sankhara dukkha, the dukkha of constructed, conditioned existence. The dukkha of being unenlightened, And we really need to engage with that. There's a very interesting sutta. It's the sutta, it's quite a famous sutta that Bhante quotes. It's, I think it's called, is it the Chula Vedala Sutta, I think it's called? It's the questions and answers sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's the dialogue between the nun, the bhikkhuni Dhammadina, and her ex-husband, Vishaka. You know, she left him to go forth. There you go, it does happen that way too. And it's a very interesting question and answer about sort of pairs of opposites, you know, which Sangharakshita has sort of picked up on. But there's one particular moment in the sutta that I think is of very great importance. It's describing somebody who's attained a certain level of meditative experience, a certain amount of jhana. They've been practicing the Dharma for a while. You know, so, you know, their dukkha, you know, their life is more pleasant. You know, things are opening up. But then there is this. She talks about someone who then starts to reflect. They're in a higher positive state. Things are going well. And you get this. Oh, when will I enter and remain in the dimension that those who are noble now enter and remain in? And as he thus nurses this yearning for the unexcelled liberations, there arises within him sorrow based on that yearning. With that, he abandons resistance. Oh, when will I enter and remain in the dimension that those who are noble now enter and remain in? And as he thus nurses this yearning for the unexcelled liberations, there arises within him sorrow based on that yearning. With that, he abandons resistance. So this is talking about a much deeper and more refined sense of dukkha that we need to cultivate. We need to start developing a vision, a real feeling for the unexcelled liberations. The unexcelled liberations, the liberations of the noble ones, of the Aryas, of the Buddhas, of the Bodhisattvas. We need to, you know, in other words, in dependence upon dukkha, arises faith, Shraddha. And here Shraddha is being described as that vision of the noble ones, of the unexcelled liberations. And we develop a yearning for that. The word is piha in Pali. We also have the phrase abhilasha Shraddha, the longing faith, the longing for those unexcelled liberations. Yes, we've come this far. You know, we've developed something. That's very, very good. But there's always further. There's always further to go. There's another sutta called the Sapurasa Sutta, the true man sutta, the man of integrity sutta, where the Buddha goes through the whole path, a man on the path, you know, from going forth right through to enlightenment. He said, a man without integrity, whatever stage he is, he identifies with his stage, his state, and uses that to exalt himself and to disparage others. But the man of integrity, wherever his state or stage, reflects, I've reached this stage, but the Dharma isn't about identifying with this stage and exalting myself. Practicing the Dharmacharya is for the removal of greed, hatred and delusion. So he goes on and on and on in this way. So this longing for the unexcelled liberation. So we need to cultivate that. Independence upon dukkha arises Shraddha. If we are going to have enlightenment sort of, as it were, present in our life as a sort of light shining, you know, before us, or as a sort of perfume pervading our life, we have to meditate regularly on independence upon dukkha arises shraddha. You know, the pain that we have isn't just a sort of bad luck. It isn't a sort of bum deal. You know, we've got it because we're embodied. We're in that situation because of craving, hatred and delusion. You know, we're in that sort of state because we are samsaric beings. We don't use that to beat ourselves up, give ourselves a hard time, or anything like that. It's just the situation. It's just the situation. But in recognizing that, you start longing. You start opening up to that which is beyond. You start yearning for the unexcelled liberations. You start really focusing on nirvana, on enlightenment. When you're ordained, in the private ordination, you are given your personal meditation practice. Your personal meditation practice. The meditation practice, which is the vision of you, as Bhante said this to me at my private ordination, this is you at the end of the path. You at the end of the higher evolution. You as you are in eternity. He even said that. You as you really are, if you could just die spiritually. And typically, this will be the meditation and mantra recitation of the Buddha or Bodhisattva. That aspect of enlightenment that really speaks to you, really communicates to you, really touches you, which you have a deep feeling for. Some people choose not to, these days, to take a particular Buddha or Bodhisattva. But there has to be, you know, something in which you meditate on every day that is the presence of enlightenment in your life, that really activates your shraddha, which makes that shraddha vibrate and resonate in you, your Buddha potential resonate in you. It's got to be there. And I think one of the reasons why I have that sense of, if you like, of Buddhahood itself, having a sort of sense of that in my life, is because I very, very rarely missed my daily meditation on my chosen Buddha or Bodhisattva that I was given at the time I was ordained. Very, very rarely missed that. It's because, as it's gone on, it's what that figure is indicating is becoming more and more mysterious, less and less understandable, less and less articulable, actually. You know, sometimes people ask me, oh, what meditation do you practice every day? And I'm increasingly reluctant to even say what it is. Because when you say it to people, say, oh yeah, I thought it was that. It's almost like your astrological sign. And they've got you sussed and they've got you down. They kind of know who you are because, you know, but that's assuming quite a lot. It means that you think you know what a bodhisattva is. You know, because you've read the books, you've maybe read Visantra's book on meeting the Buddhas, and there's all the descriptions and all the rest of it, or, you know, Bhante's descriptions or these Tibetan books and all the rest of it. You think you know what a Buddha or Bodhisattva is. You know what, you know, Amitabha's red and Tara's green and Padmasambhava's lots of colours and Vajrasattva's white and they hold this and they do that. Of course we don't know who they are at all. We don't know the reality of these figures at all. These forms are really important. These crystallizations are really important because they're communicating to us. There's a resonance between us and them. They spark off that shraddha within us, that longing. But but as you go on in meditating on these figures, you realize that you know less and less, and yet they become more vivid. They become more real to you, more a force, you know, in your life. But it's the same. It's the same whether you were talking about enlightenment in terms of Pratitya Samuppada or Anatman or not self or impermanence or Shunyata, you know, or wisdom or compassion or liberation. And we use all these words, or, you know, pure, absolutely, you know, undivided, completely open-ended, luminous, non-dual consciousness, all that sort of thing. We use all these words. They spark us off. They do something. But just because we have all these words and images, it doesn't mean we know what they really mean. Their meaning, the meaning of enlightenment, is found in living. It's found in the life of practice, setting up the conditions that lead on and on to, you know, on and on to Buddhahood, on and on to enlightenment. And particularly that sense of independence upon dukkha arises shraddha. Independence upon that, well, that deep, deep sorrow, that deep sense of lack, of unenlightenment, of distance, that deep longing for Buddhahood itself. That's the place where we need to stay. That's the place where we need to be. And that will then affect all of our behaviour. We'll start looking very, very closely at what we do. We'll look at our precepts. You know, we'll see, how can I possibly think in terms of attaining enlightenment when I still harm living beings? When I'm still harsh in my speech? When I'm still unmindful, you know, in the most basic way? And that doesn't become something that, as I say, you feel guilty about, you beat yourself up about, and, you know, you can't get out of bed any longer and all the rest of it, you know, because I can't get enlightenment. No, you just sort of say, you just redouble your efforts. You just redouble your efforts. You do everything you can, you know, to move along the path, you know, to Buddhahood. And yes, there may well be glimpses. There may well be those wonderful moments. There you are, suddenly, meditating, or going for a walk, or in a puja, or at the end of a puja, in communication, in a study group, where for a moment you seem to see. It's just all clear. There's a flash, a kind of insight into the nature of things, an expansiveness, a bliss, an overwhelming love in which you get completely lost in. Those things happen, they do arise. But, you know, you don't cling onto them, you don't grab onto them, you don't use them to exalt yourself and negate others. You just see them as something to feel really joyful about, and you move on. Independence upon dukkha arises shraddha. Independence upon shraddha arises joy. Pamoja, pramudita, joyfulness. Independence upon joy arises priti, ecstasy. Independence upon ecstasy arises bliss. Independence upon bliss arises samadhi, deep absorption. Independence upon samadhi arises the knowledge and vision of things as they really are. And then after that, open up the liberations, the letting go and the liberations. So we need to have a real feeling for this, a real feeling that the Dharma life is a living thing, a growing thing. I'll just end, I think, with, to give us a feeling for this, with some words in that lecture as enlightenment, as experience and non-experience. Here's Sangharakshita's, if you like, vision of in enlightenment. I'll read you two sections, one about nirvana and one about what the path really is. In the Dhammapada, we encounter the same, nirvanam paramam sukham. Nirvana is the supreme bliss. And the question naturally arose as to what was the difference between ordinary worldly bliss, including heavenly bliss, and supreme or nirvanic bliss. The answer was that worldly bliss depended on contact between the sense organs and the mind on the one hand, and their respective physical and mental objects on the other. Thus, worldly bliss, depending on some kind of contact between a subject and an object. Hence, worldly bliss depends on experience. It is a form of experience. But nirvanic bliss is not so dependent. It does not arise in dependence upon any sort of contact, and it is not the product of contact. When all contacts cease, that is nirvana. That is the bliss of nirvana. Nirvana is not an experience, and we can only describe it as a non-experience. Nirvana is the experience you have when you've stopped experiencing. Wow. But then he talks about the Dharma life in terms of growth. So he talks about some of the great images in the Buddhist tradition, the Buddha's vision of all beings as lotuses, you know, growing up towards the light, and it was because of that vision that he taught the Dharma out of compassion. We're living beings, we're growing beings. He talks about the parable of the rain cloud and the Dharma as being like a great rain cloud, and we are like all the individual plants growing towards enlightenment. So he makes a lot of this language of growth. We're not trying to grab an experience, we're growing in the Dharma. And then he says this, talks about what a great image, the image of the so it's a great image, that of the plant and the flower. But images, however beautiful and however appropriate, also have their limitations. A flower fades, a flower loses its petals. In the case of the spiritual life, however, it's not like that, and we therefore have to stretch our imagination quite a bit further. We have to expand and develop our image and say that when the flower of enlightenment blooms, that flower does not fade. Its petals do not fall. The rest of the plant, the stalk and the leaves may drop away, but that flower remains on its own, remains, as it were, suspended in the sky, floating. We could even say that the whole plant has become a flower. Moreover, this flower, like other flowers, contains the seeds, and as the flower floats there in the sky, those seeds grow into plants. All those plants produce flowers, and as all those flowers too remain floating in the sky, and as this process continues to eternity, eventually the whole of space becomes filled with flowers. This is the kind of vision we see in some kinds of meditation. The whole of space filled with a vast network of great golden lotus flowers, a network that is expanding to infinity in all directions. That is what the Buddhist life is really like. That's what the Dharmacharya's life is really like. So I hope I said at the beginning of this talk, I didn't know what to say. I've talked a lot, but I hope there's some feeling there for that vow for the attainment of enlightenment. I accept this ordination.